The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSI.
Like the feeling you get when first waking up from a wild night in Mexico, you are now Skeptically Speaking, where we ask you to call in and question everything, including why you can never drink tequila again. Tonight's show is hosted by your best cure for a hangover of irrationality. Take it away, Desiree.
You know, those get weirder and weirder.
That they do.
All right. Hello, everyone. Today on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking to Howard Strauss about the movie A Beautiful Truth, the world's simplest cure for cancer. The film features the Gerson diet, the controversial alternative cancer treatment. But first, we have some other things to talk about. First of all, I wanted to apologize profusely about last week's show and the tech issues. All those who emailed or called or attempted in vain to phone in, I'm so sorry. I blame... what am I blaming?
Me.
No, I'm not going to blame Sean.
Oh, the Skype gremlins.
The Skype gremlins.
Those
totally,
little guys.
Yes. Yes. The station trolls.
You know, every time I looked out of our little round window here in the studio, I could see that little one on the wing.
What movie is that from? Creepshow. That was Creepshow.
No, that's from an old Twilight Zone episode.
Oh, Twilight Zone. Sweet. Okay, good. Good. Well, regardless, I'm in the studio this week, and my very presence will avert any technical difficulties.
There you will be none. Our good luck charm.
I know. Yes. Yes, there will be none. None, I say.
Yes, boss.
Thank you. And if you say it three times fast, it comes true.
Or you could bypass the three times and just go right to the secret. That works too.
Right, because wishing hard enough makes it happen.
Agreed.
Okay. But to get off the topic of my horrible embarrassment, let's give some local skeptics a chance to shine on speaking up. We have today our biggest fanboy, Nathan.
Hello.
He actually gets to be in the show today. And as well as intern Ryan.
Hello.
He's way too far away from the mic.
Hello again.
Okay. And they'll be speaking about their recent field trip to the Mind, Body, and Soul Expo. Right. Good. Thanks, guys. So that's an interesting excursion for a couple of skeptics.
It certainly was when we walked in. It was a veritable cornucopia of woo.
Ooh.
We, of course, walked in and saw numerous psychics on display, alternative health, and, speaking of the secret, the law of attraction, as well as quantum healing and quantum devices, magnets, just everything woo under the sun.
And quality titanium cookware.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah. What's that for?
Lonely booth, just sitting there selling what can only be described as probably quality cookware.
Did they join up for the wrong show? Or
I don't know. They weren't making any strange claims. They were just selling cookware.
The poor guy looked actually pretty lonely.
Yeah, very.
Selling something normal. Who's actually going to take that serious there? No, if it was quantum cookware, then we would have a different...
quantum cookware would be an interesting new woo. I would like to see that. Somebody please make up a quantum cookware scam.
I would totally buy that, actually.
I want to see it.
I think we patent that right now. I'll be on the internet here. Ryan, do you want to tell us about your favorite display of woo?
Okay, well, there were free booths that were trying to sell various quantum things. One was quantum science, one was quantum numerology, and one had a really long name that I don't remember. But I did try to find out why they were quantum. I would go up and I would ask the person, why is this quantum? And in two cases, I was told that the only person that knows was currently busy talking to someone else, so I should come back later. And the other booth was busy, so I couldn't get any questions at all. I would have liked to have asked them more things about quantum physics that they probably had no idea about, like the Schrodinger equation, I don't know, complex numbers, all that cool stuff that any physics student hates, but that these people probably don't pay any attention to. But unfortunately, I did not get the chance.
That's a shame. How about for you, Nathan? Is there a favorite?
Well, you know, there was so much to choose from. I mean, there was the multi-level marketing Zango juice. There was, of course, the psychic. They had a gypsy hut. with a psychic in it.
Dude, an actual hut.
An actual hut. You know, with the standard beads and cushions on the inside.
Any tea readers?
I'm sorry?
Any tea readers? Tea leaf readers?
I'm not sure. There was just so much. There was tarot cards, cold reading of various varieties.
There was a guy who claimed to be an Atlantean.
Oh, it was...
Really?
Yes. He had this poncho, a ponytail. It was great.
And you know, if you have a ponytail, you're totally for real.
See, I thought the gills under the chin would be the giveaway there, but...
Painful.
He actually looked like he was straight out of Sonoma.
Oh.
But we also listened to a presentation from a gentleman from Share International. And he talked about the coming leader who's going to lead the world, named Maitreya. Ryan?
Yes, he did. Apparently, this Maitreya... Oh, one thing I think is significant to talk about here is the fact that this guy has jumped all over the economic crisis and is using it to sell his crap by saying that his organization predicted this, I don't know, 30 years ago or whatever, and this guy called Maitreya will appear on TV preaching love and all that crap. And we won't know who he is then, but at some point in the future, he will appear on TV at the same time to everybody all over the world, and he won't say anything, but we will all know that this is Maitreya, and that we are all one with God, and that we are all divine beings, and that will be the end of all our problems.
Well then.
He, of course, also had some contradictory information. I mean, here's
color me surprised.
This is his Emergence Quarterly, and here he's got a picture of Maitreya appearing in Kenya in 1998. Yet, when you take a look on the inside, he uses the 1995... Fuhrer over the Ganesh statues in the Hindu temples drinking milk as being the sign of a soul descending from heaven. So one needs to ask, did Maitreya come in 1998 or was it 1995?
Maitreya's always been here in my opinion, but...
Or he could have come twice.
Yeah, maybe
he was
maybe
busy
he stops,
for a while.
He stops by every little once in a while, knocks on Earth's door and says, hello, how you doing? We are running out of time here. You guys had mentioned as well to me that there was a number of local ghost hunters there as well. Did you want to finish up maybe telling us about that one?
Well, I don't know if they were ghost hunters or were just offering a tour, but there was a company called Night Tours, I think, that apparently offers a ghost tour of Edmonton. We already knew there was another one called Edmonton Ghost Tours, which we didn't get a chance to do last year. But yeah, it'd be nice to check these guys out in the summer.
Great.
Perhaps a future field report from our local skeptics right there.
Frontline skepticism.
Well, you know, I was thinking about, you know, taking my vacation and going to the Tyrrell Museum, the huge dinosaur museum outside of Drumheller. But, you know, I think maybe this might actually be more fun. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
All right, so if you want to have your say on Speaking Up, do send off a quick email proposal to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. And I actually don't know if we mentioned this before, but this can be done over the phone, people, or Skype, now that Sean has sorted all the bits out.
I conquered the gremlins, and now we are Skype equipped, yes. Oh. It's true.
So don't let not being a local skeptic stop you. We will give any skeptic a sciencey or secular forum. Feel free.
And mention next week we will be talking about the science and psychology of grocery stores, how they're laid out, and all the interesting science behind that field of consumer interaction. I don't know. I didn't really prepare this.
Okay, well, if you would like to have your whole 5 minutes of skeptical famousness, well, maybe, you know, as much famousness as a community radio station program can provide. But we are rebroadcast on 3 other radio stations. So this is my official shout out to all of our listeners on Free Thought Radio, WPRR Public Radio, and Citywide LPFM. You listeners, definitely, we want you here. And speaking of your 5 minutes of fame, listeners, if you want to get into the phone queue, do dial 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email questions to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, but not on Twitter today.
Yeah, Twitter has been acting up a little bit today. You can try it, but you may not be heard.
It was very frustrating earlier.
But in the future, Skeptical Radio on Twitter is who you want to follow for the latest news on the show outside of the blog and the show itself.
And now on to Brownian Motion.
That's funny, I was in Kenya in 1999, and if any harbinger of peace and love was there, it certainly wasn't in any newspapers or anything like that. So, yeah. Probably the easiest thing to do is to come up with some strange god and then mention that they showed up in some exotic locale, forgetting that Kenya's not really so exotic now that it is, you know, the third millennium.
Right.
Anyway, and I'm curious, if Nathan's here, who's going to phone in first? The phones are open, I guess.
Well, you know, Nathan is not on the air right now. So, you know what? I wouldn't put it past him to have this all pre-programmed. He did that once.
All right. Well, 2 weeks ago, if anybody remembers that far back, I mentioned the colorful names for the patterns researchers and enthusiasts had found in John Conway's Game of Life. But it turns out, and I guess it probably goes without saying, that the A-Life community isn't the only one with a tendency towards creatively unorthodox names. So before I get into that, as is my wont, I'm going to go into a long rambling backstory about all of this. You've probably heard of the gene called Hedgehog. Gene called Hedgehog. It's like a movie. There was a movie like that, 1970, something like that, with Richard Harris, the original Dumbledore. Anyways, it's a gene name for the signaling protein it produces, also called Hedgehog. Okay, so I guess these guys aren't so creative. In Drosophila, this protein is produced in a gradient that instructs the embryo to develop according to its body plan. So in other words, grow a head on one end, grow a tail on the other end, put the left and right sides in the appropriate places, sprout a few legs and some antenna. But the reason that it's called Hedgehog is that a mutation in this gene causes the Drosophila embryo to be shorter and squatter than the wild-type ones and covered in a lawn of denticles rather than having segment bands of them. And denticles are these little bumpy protuberances that Drosophila apparently have. It's been a long time since I've seen one, so. But it turns out that this gene is part of a complex of genes called the Hedgehog signaling pathway, the discovery of which was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology in 1995. But aside from answering the question of how an embryonic ball of cells knows how to develop the right number of heads and legs, and since I'm on the radio, you guys probably can't see this, but I was doing the air quotes to indicate that I'm using the word knows figuratively because it's just a blastocyst, a bag of cells, and doesn't know anything. But anyways, the hedgehog signaling pathway is another important piece of the evidence for evolution, as it's conserved through animal lineages from flies all the way through humans. Just like another complex of morphogenesis-regulating genes known as the Hox genes. But mammals, including humans, don't have the hedgehog genes, but instead we have three interestingly named homologs. The first one is called Sonic Hedgehog Homolog, or SHH, which is the funny one. The other two are named for actual hedgehog species, the desert hedgehog homolog and the Indian hedgehog homolog. So this is where the creatively unorthodox nomenclature I was talking about comes into play. In the course of researching all of this, I came across a website called Curiosities of Biological Nomenclature by our favorite, a skeptic and anti-creationist named Mark Isaac. The site is a huge archive of interesting species names, like the trilobite, this one's going to be a long one, Agrota catellus, which translates to sick puppy. A fossil amphibian, Eucrita melanolimnides, which means creature from the Black Lagoon. The gastropod, Piscinotecus divae, whose name means I stepped on Tico. Apparently it's named because one of the discoverers, heading to the kitchen in the middle of the night, stepped on their dog, which was named Tico. And decided to name, I don't know what happened there, if they decided.
I want to be a scientist. Well, I want to name things random things. That's not fair.
I guess you've just got to have a rock hammer and a couple of loose bolts up top.
Oh.
But pardon me, the archives also include the names of genes mentioned, of the genes that I was talking about, but a whack load of other ones, like bag of marbles, which is a gene involved, and this kind of makes sense, oogenesis and spermatogenesis. Cleopatra, which is a mutation that's lethal, but only if it's in the presence of another mutation called ASP. Lush, which is a gene that mediates responses to alcohols, and a gene that jumps around the genome of the green algae, Volvox, which are those little algae, I don't know, you study them in biology. And it's called the Jordan element after Michael Jordan, Air Jordan, for the jumping ability.
Wow.
Of course, not every scientist walks around with a list of puns just waiting to be foisted upon some unsuspecting species or gene. After all the grant writing, research, and more grant writing, sometimes the best they can come up with are names like Ring for really interesting new gene. So that's all I've got for today. But if you want to follow the links posted in Brownian Motion on skepticallyspeaking.com on Sunday, I've got links to this website. You can read more strange and interesting species, genera, and gene names, including some great puns and insults. And paleontologists are known for having rivalries, especially Cope and Marsh way back, the great dinosaur hunters of the 1800s, and they embedded all sorts of insults at each other in species names. So honestly, check it out. I'll also have a link to Mark Isaac's book, The Count Creation Handbook, and one of the best guides to Latin and Greek words, so you can test my translations for yourself, used in science, the Donald J. Boer's Dictionary of Word Roots and Combining Forms. So there.
Thanks so much, Brownie. It's awesome.
You're welcome.
And now for a brief interlude.
Here at Skeptically Speaking, we encourage you to call in and question everything. During tonight's episode, you can call in at 780-492-CJSR, extension 1, to join in on the conversation. Again, that number is 780-492-2577, extension 1. If you're a little bit shy, please email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or message Skeptical Radio on Twitter. After the show, feel free to comment on tonight's episode at skepticallyspeaking.com. We'd also love to see you join our Skeptically Speaking Facebook group or have you follow Skeptical Radio on Twitter. Of course, if you want to reach us the old school way, you can always email us at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com.
Hello, listeners. Please note that during our interview with Howard Strauss, we had some technical difficulties which caused the interview to be split up into two halves. For the sake of continuity, I've put the interview together with the first 10 minutes of off-topic discussion playing first. I'd also like to apologize for the first 5 minutes of the interview, in which there's a strong level of static and popping noises, ending with some short-lived echoing when Howard was reconnected. One part of the interview is extremely difficult to hear, and as a result, that segment was removed from the edit and has been placed at the very end of the show after the promo. Thanks again for listening, and enjoy the rest of the program.
We do apologize for that, everyone. The clicking and hissing is an unknown phenomenon around here. We're just going to get Howard back on the line in the next couple minutes here, try to figure this out. We did notice a little bit of clicking last week, too, so hopefully this isn't some sign of a larger problem here at the studio.
Oh, don't say that. I'm skeptical of the whole jinxing something procedure, but, you know, as a symbolic gesture, just don't talk about it.
Gotcha. It's like the break your leg on the...
Yeah, but that's supposed to be a good thing.
Well, exactly. Anyway.
Okay.
We're just getting him switched on the air here. We will mention again just quickly, once we do get Howard back on the line, you can call 780-492-2577, extension 1, to join in on the conversation. And do we have Howard on the line now, Ryan? Line 2, perhaps? No. Nope. We thought we were all past the technical difficulties this time.
You know, that whole saying it 3 times thing, that didn't work, and the wishing didn't work. I don't know. What's the next step?
Well, I can call from Skype if this really doesn't work.
No. What I'd like to do is the non-technical stuff, like the wishing and the hoping. Do we have other wishing and hoping things that I can do? Because really... audience, if you've been listening from the start of this show, you know I have no technical aptitude whatsoever. You put me near the buttons and it will sound far worse than this, people. Something may actually explode.
Right. Well, you know, if we could always go for the rabbit's foot technique instead. Nathan's still on the grounds. Maybe he'll chase us down a rabbit to
get us a... We'll get a lot of trouble for that.
Really?
One.
Okay, Rabbit. I never really understood that. That seems like the worst luck ever. Like, a limb from an animal is good luck because it wasn't good luck for them. You know?
I agree. Especially if you take off the limb, like, with a piece of a mirror.
Okay, okay, Ryan, okay. Hurry.
Well, maybe we could talk a little bit about vampires for a few seconds.
Did really? That's that? Is that your go-to comment?
It's the only
like,
story that's up on my laptop
vampires?
Here. Well, how about where vampires came from? This actually comes from the Center for Inquiry blog. I just had the story open from earlier. And it actually talks a little bit about where the whole vampire idea came from. Would you like to know more?
Oh my
god, no choice,
I just felt like Starship Troopers. Would you like to know more? And then you click the little button.
All right, we're going to try the line here. We can learn more about vampires a little later on. Howard, are you there this time? Hello, Howard? This is odd. Little red button's on, everything's drawn up.
Audience, you too can be a part of this process.
Yes, you can. All right.
You know what? Anybody? Open phone line. 492-2577 extension 1. Do call in. Tell us anything.
All right. Well,
occupy me.
As an example of something you might call in and say, vampires. So, what would happen? It's pretty interesting. Where the whole it's good to know where a myth came from. Basically, the belief in vampires was augmented by the appearance of decomposing corpses encountered when mass graves were reopened for interment of the newly dead. The older corpses were typically bloated and this is actually really,
are you
really dark.
Really?
And had
this
blood
is what's
seeping
up
from
on
the
your
mouth.
Laptop.
Yes. Often there was an unexplained hole in the shroud covering the corpse's face. These were held to be evidence of the vampire's drinking of other people's blood and consuming his own shroud.
Well...
Now, forensic science now shows that the bloating and blood were due to the effects of decomposition. But a few hundred years ago, vampires didn't seem like such a bad little reason, did they?
And now you know.
You know, I can da 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 da, the star floating above our heads.
You know, while they deal with this, I've brought Brownie into the studio. No pressure, though.
I'm absolutely nothing prepared.
That's okay. Amuse me.
That was I really liked the vampire story. That was interesting. Any other myths?
Yeah.
Are the microphones in here even going? You know, it's funny because when I was young, brownie and nerd, I used to haunt the library at my local elementary all the time. And I loved reading about things like vampires and werewolves and the Bermuda Triangle and all that sort of skeptical, well, not skeptical, that sort of stuff at that time. It's kind of interesting because I guess that, I don't know if I could say where my skepticism came from, but I'd say there might be a relationship to being exposed to that earlier wacky stuff and being really, really fascinated by it and then slowly finding out one by one, you know, this myth gets demolished when you read an article about something, about, say, the Bermuda Triangle or something like that, like the fact that it doesn't really exist whatsoever.
But some people never move past that point. You know, they develop a fascination while they're young. And then the older they get, the more entrenched they become that's not just a fascinating story. That's something that has real, tangible evidence. And by evidence, I mean testimonials and subjective validation and confirmation bias.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not aware of any books, although I know this has been studied, what causes somebody to take that shift or to move from one side to the other, from going from being an unrepentant believer to... I mean, I've always had a stitch of cynicism in me, but I mean, when I was young, I studied Kung Fu and I was all into Chi and that sort of thing, although I do remember having, you know, these little doubts in the back of my mind, but I wanted to believe and I wanted to, you know, buy in, so I did and kind of went along with the whole thing. And actually, I was telling Nathan and Ryan earlier while we were waiting for the show to start about when I was young, even some of the experiences that I had when I was studying and exploring this, experiences that if I was a different person, I would have considered them to be supernatural or something like that. But now I know were just interesting experiences that one would have after meditating or exercising for a length of time.
And, give me an example.
I once experienced, or at least had the subjective experience of time slowing down. and that, and it was really, really fascinating. And I do remember mentioning it to my instructors, and they were a little bit, they weren't quite dismissive, but I really got the impression that that was not an uncommon experience to happen, and they didn't necessarily ascribe any supernatural or any mystical qualities to it. But I do remember it having a very strong impact on me because I was there. I felt it. That's exactly what my experience was. And yet, I don't think there's anything out of the ordinary or anything beyond just the normal function of how the human brain works, especially in different circumstances, under heightened stress or having or low blood sugar or having exercise. It was really, really neat. So, but here I sit, an unrepentant skeptic now. So, you know, it's funny. Sometimes too, people think that there's a kind of a closing of the doors based on that.
How so?
Well, that the idea that, you know, if you're a skeptic, things aren't interesting or the world is devoid of mystery. But in fact, it's the opposite. Oh, sorry. Did I hear a brain cell? Obviously, you heard that too.
And it drives me insane because I think, to tell you the truth, when I was younger and I believed in a lot more of these interesting, you know, supernatural and paranormal kind of things, the world wasn't as interesting because it felt fairly one-dimensional, even though I thought maybe this could be true. None of it had ever really happened to me, and it wasn't engaging personally. I thought, well, that's a really interesting story. I wonder about that. But as you start to learn about the world, like tangible pieces of the world, about science, I think the world is far more fascinating because that's something you can engage in. Like unless you want to be running around a graveyard at midnight yelling, you know, I'm a virgin, you can't really be involved in the whole vampire process.
Well, don't we all want to do that though? Does one have to believe in vampires to be running around naked in midnight yelling I'm a virgin in a...
What have I started here?
All I'm saying is that is a still, that's one step removed from the process. But with science, you can become so much more involved with that. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I agree with you completely. That's something that I feel. And I think similarly to you, the more I found out about... When I was young, I had some. My parents had friends that gave me this National Geographic book that was produced in the 80s called Our Universe, and it was full of all these glossy pictures of Saturn and that, and it was really fascinating because I remember at the time Jupiter was known to have 12 moons and Saturn 14 or something like that, and we now know that Saturn and Jupiter each have, I think, in the realm of 20, if not more. But I remember that being a really... First of all, I love that book, and I devoured it, and I just sit there and, you know, drool over the pages all day long and, you know, look at images of planets and galaxies and nebula. But it was interesting as I got older, and then I'd go back to that knowledge... And then find out I was wrong, like about the moons of Jupiter. That knowledge was current at the time.
Right.
And that seemed to me to be really, really fascinating to say, oh, wow, this is really neat. In fact, you know, we're just scratching the iceberg, the tip of the iceberg and all this information. So, that was... And it was funny because my dad was never so into space, but he really liked the ocean. So I was getting it from. So I've got the astronomy and the galaxy books and that, and then National Geographics and all sorts of.
Dude, it was all about Funk and Wagnalls with me.
Funk and Wagnalls?
Absolutely. I went through that entire encyclopedia set, and little known fact about me: when I was young, I used to look at the pictures of the tarantulas and purposely scare the crap out of myself. I'd open to the page and I'd be like, ah! Then I'd put it back. And
you
I would
know,
do
tarantulas
that over.
Aren't all that poisonous. They're
no,
actually not that
I
dangerous.
Realize.
But
that's
they funny. do have urticating hairs that they can. That what they'll do is they'll raise up on their hind legs and flurry their forelegs and release a cloud of these little hairs that they grow on their stomach that easily break off. And in fact, mice have been known to be killed because they irritate the membranes. So if you do encounter a tarantula, don't worry so much about it biting. But if it stands on its hind legs and starts gesturing at you rudely and angrily, you might want to step back or at least close your eyes.
See, and this is why we have Brownie in on the show. You know, I just have to let the audience in on this. A couple episodes ago, I was like, Brownie, I would never normally say this, but really, more funny, less content. And he's doing it justice, and I'm liking it.
Hi there. I'm going to just cut right in here. Howard, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Howard.
Okay.
Thanks, Brownian, for helping me fill space.
Thanks a lot. All right, take it away.
Welcome back, all. We are on the line with Howard Strauss. Howard appeared in the movie A Beautiful Truth, the world's simplest cure for cancer. The movie deals with one of the more controversial alternative cancer treatments, the Gerson diet. And Howard is also the grandson of Max Gerson, the creator of the treatment. Good to have you with us, Howard. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, hello. Sorry.
Sorry, I hadn't pushed the magic red button.
All the magic red button. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks very much, Howard. So, first off, do tell us a bit about the movie.
Well, the movie is the story of the Gerson therapy, but the way it's approached is as a homeschool project for a 16-year-old who is given Max Gerson's book, Cancer Therapy, Results of 50 Cases, to do a report on by his father. The boy had lost his mother in a very, very serious accident just shortly before that, and his behavior, his schoolwork, everything was deteriorating seriously. And so his father took him out of school and gave him homeschooling. And the question was, is Dr. Gerson's treatment real? Who else knows about it? Are there results? Is there hope? Why is it not known? And it follows his project to speaking with many experts in food, in chemicals, in cancer, in surgery, and so forth, to do his final report. And in the end, he becomes convinced that Dr. Gerson's therapy is real, and he does his report, and he now feels that he has to tell the world.
Okay, well, I'm just wondering, the director, Steve Chrischel, does he have a link to the Gerson diet? Did he have a previous relationship to the diet, or...?
Well, yes, he did. Steve Chrischel, first of all, this is his third documentary on the Gerson therapy. He himself, some years ago, probably almost 10 years ago now, was concerned about his own health because he was getting over 40, and he was a single dad, and he was worried about his own health. He runs a wild animal farm up in Haines, Alaska. Plus, he does cinematography on avalanches, and it's a very physically demanding job, or a couple of physically demanding jobs. He runs the farm all by himself. So he was concerned about staying healthy on for another 10, 20 years so he could raise his son. And he spoke to his mentor, Bill Bacon, who's known as the steadiest hand with a camera in Alaska. Man used to work for Walt Disney. He handed Steve Gerson's book. Steve thought it made a lot of sense, particularly since he is involved with nutritionally matching the food he gives all of the different animals he has. He has herbivores, he has caribou, he has bear, he has porcupine and wolves, so all manner of animals. And he has to feed them properly or else they won't survive long. And they won't come back to him if he lets them out in the wild. And that's one of the things he does with his cinematography. So he thought this made an awful lot of sense. And he started to live on that therapy himself. And it gave him such incredible benefits just as a healthy person in terms of energy, health. He never caught a cold anymore. He never fell ill anymore. That he just felt he wanted to give back. And so that was his beginning of his connection with the Gerson therapy.
And what's your connection to the Gerson therapy?
Mine is genetic. Dr. Mm-hmm. Max Gerson was my grandfather. Charlotte Gerson is my mother. And as far as that goes, nobody else is really picking up the banner. My mother is no longer able to, or no longer. No longer energy energetic enough. She's 87 years old. After she's no longer able to carry the banner, it will fall to you to do so.
Let's go right back to your grandfather. So your grandfather created the diet. Your mother started the Gerson Institute?
That's correct.
Perfect. And just to clarify, so neither of you are medical doctors, but you both train physicians in the Gerson treatment.
That's correct. If we were medical doctors, we would be held hostage by our licenses. And the medical board would hold it over our heads. By the way, can you hear the echo?
Oh, I can hear the echo. He's working on it. Do continue.
The medical board would hold us hostage by our licenses, as most doctors are held hostage. If the doctor in the United States tries to even mention the Gerson therapy as a remedy for anything, he has his license lifted.
Really?
Or in the state of Washington, is brought up on sanity hearings. In other states, he is prosecuted, like California, he's prosecuted for a felony and fined $10,000 and a year in jail for each instance.
Well,
so it's very draconian difficulties for a doctor with a medical license. It is our lack of medical license that allows us to operate relatively freely.
Well, can you actually just explain the Gerson diet to the listeners?
It's very simple. It involves vegan nutrition, flooding the body with available whole organic nutrients from fresh pressed vegetable and fruit juices 13 times a day, detoxification using coffee enemas, and supplementation with vitamins, minerals, and herbs, and enzymes, all of which are part of the human physiology anyway. So these are not patentable because, of course, they're natural substances. This is why the conventional medical and pharmaceutical world doesn't like us, because there's nothing that we use that can be patented and thus made into an artificial scarcity that people can make a fortune off of.
Okay, I'd like to actually get into the suppression by the medical community a little bit further on. So I can understand the drinking juice part and even the eating organic part, because depending on which studies you're looking at and the specific results you're looking for, eating organic definitely, you know, does have benefits. But I'd like clarification on the enemas, I have to say.
Right.
Caffeine enemas?
The coffee enema. It has to be coffee.
Okay.
And not decaf either. It has to be full caffeinated coffee. The coffee enema was actually discovered to be a tremendous pain relief during World War I when the United States and its allies cut Germany off from its import of exotic substances, which is where they got most analgesics. So all of these thousands upon thousands of battle casualties during World War I were deprived of analgesics, which were the raw materials for which were imported from Southeast Asia. So accidentally, the nurses discovered that if they gave the soldiers, post-operatively, if they gave the soldiers coffee enemas, that the soldiers experienced tremendous pain relief. And so that became the treatment of choice for pain relief, for post-operative pain relief in the German MASH units during World War I. And after the war, two physicians who had witnessed that did some research and found that what was happening was when the caffeine was introduced rectally rather than drunk. It was transported directly through the hemorrhoidal vein and the portal venous system directly to the liver, and it stimulated the liver to release toxicity, release poisons. And it was the poisons that were irritating the nerve endings and causing pain. Thus, when you remove the poisons from the bloodstream, and it no longer irritated the nerve endings, and the pain would be relieved. Well, when Gerson started to treat cancer, he found that the body was killing cancer cells so rapidly and dumping the dead necrotic material and detoxifying the cellular structure of the body so rapidly, it was dumping all of these toxins into the liver, and the patient would actually die from hepatic coma, from liver intoxication. And he needed some way to support the liver to remove the toxicity that was being dumped on it so rapidly. And he remembered the experiments that Huebner and Meyer had done at the University of Göttingen. And he said, aha, I can help the liver get rid of that toxicity with coffee enemas.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit more about enemas, but we have a call. Oh, no, sorry, our call has gone away.
Yes, yes.
Okay, sorry. So you're talking about you use the coffee enemas to detoxify, but there's no scientific evidence that humans actually need to be detoxified.
That humans need to be detoxified?
Mm-hmm. There's actually no evidence that I can find that there would be any reason for any artificial means or, you know, additional means of detoxification.
Well, yeah, there's very good reason for that. And the reason for that is that if doctors really, really admitted that the human body was very, very toxic and needed to be detoxified, they'd have to say, okay, we don't know how to detoxify the body. We have no idea how to detoxify it. And then if they really did careful tests, they would find that most of the toxins in the body are caused by doctors and the food that we eat, by the pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceuticals, because they are patented material, they have to be unnatural molecules. And unnatural molecules in the long run are all liver toxic in the long run. Now, when you consider that over the last maybe 100 years, there are some 80,000 chemicals that have been released into our environment, developed, synthesized, and released into our environment, many of which we ingest and incorporate into our cellular structure, and all of them being unnatural materials, the body has no idea how to cope with them, and they end up, at very best, neutral, or in most cases, they end up toxic. To imagine that we don't need detoxification is stretches the imagination.
Okay, well, what specific toxins does a caffeine enema remove?
It removes anything that is inimical to the body. Well, for instance, pharmaceuticals. Just one pharmaceutical, Vioxx, killed 144,000 Americans and injured millions more. That's got to be toxic, right? Because otherwise it wouldn't have killed people. The fluoride that we have in our water, the pesticides that are residual in our foods. Food processing chemicals, dyes, flavor enhancers, MSG, aspartame, the hormonal residues and the antibiotic residues that are in our cattle and in our food. They're all toxic to our system, and over time, the accumulation of all these toxins literally overwhelms our ability to clear the body of these toxins and let us heal.
Okay, I was actually looking for, you know, have you done studies specifically on how caffeine enemas detoxify, you know, the body of certain toxins?
You mean the mechanism?
Yes.
The mechanism is that the caffeine stimulates the liver to produce bile, and the bile flushes out of the liver and into the upper intestinal tract, and the bile carries with it the toxins that have been accumulated in the liver and helps the liver to clear itself. It's sort of like back flushing your pool filter, except with your liver.
Okay, we have an email question actually as well. We have an email question. Sorry, it's 6:47. Yeah. We're vaguely running out of time, and our phone queue is full. There's many people who want to talk to you.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so the first question is, how come we weren't disease-free before all the chemicals?
Well, we weren't disease-free, but I will tell you this: the number of degenerative chronic diseases, especially things like cancer. And rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia and things like that were almost nil compared to what they are today. For instance, back at the turn of the last century, in the just early 1900s, cancer was considerably less. The occurrence of cancer was considerably less than 1 in 50 people. They didn't even keep that kind of statistics until it became 1 in 50 in the early decades of the 20th century. Today, cancer occurs in 1 out of 2.3 people, and its incidence is rising. So although cancer did exist before then, it was so rare as to be almost a rarity. The people would be brought around from medical school to medical school so that the student physicians could see what cancer looked like. Nowadays, there's no problem in finding someone with cancer.
Well, one part of it, too, I mean, our diagnostic tools are just so much more sophisticated these days that there's types of cancers and places where it hides that without modern tools to be able to detect these cancers that we wouldn't even know they existed back then. Couldn't it be a matter of diagnosis as well, at least partially?
No, they knew very well what cancer was back then. As a matter of fact, if you look at I just read John Adams' biography, and his daughter had breast cancer, and they knew what breast cancer was even back in the late 1700s. They knew what cancer was. They could see cancer. I went to a museum at the University of Berlin, the medical museum at the University of Berlin. And they're preserved in bottles of formaldehyde were various different cancer tumors from 100 years ago. So they knew what cancer was. It just didn't occur very often.
All right. Well, in between thoughts here, we do have a caller here. Nathan, are you on the line there?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yes. We do seem to be getting a little bit of that clicking we had before, but we'll give you a chance to give it a shot here.
Yeah, strangely enough, by the way, I can't hear the guest over the phone.
Oh, okay.
So I'll just try and make this quick. What I was wondering about is, I was reading on Dr. Stephen Barrett's website, Quackwatch, about the Gerson treatment, and there seems to be a high number of patients who've been treated with the Gerson program who have died of cancer. And I was just wondering what you have to say about that. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks,
well,
Nathan.
Yes. Generally, the patients who come to us only come to us after they've been declared terminal by conventional physicians. And by the way, Quackwatch is a website that is supported by the pharmaceutical companies, and they hire large numbers of advertising flacks to fill it with nonsense. But yes, the large numbers of patients on the Gerson therapy die, but a large number of patients survive. And when you consider that almost all of the patients we get started out terminal, in other words, they should be 100% mortality, we can save between 30 and 40% of these people. Then any one of whom would be considered a miraculous recovery and would make headline news if it were done by conventional medicine. The kinds of cancer that we do succeed with, pancreatic cancer, advanced melanoma, liver cancer, these are cancers that have zero recovery rate on conventional management. But we have success rates in the 30 and 40% range. That's in very advanced cases. In the very early cases, we have nearly 100%, but very few people come to us in the early stages.
Well, would you suggest that a patient discontinue other cancer treatments if they wanted to try the Gerson diet? Or can you use multiple methods at one time?
Using multiple methods is problematical with the Gerson therapy, especially when you talk about something like chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is there's talk about toxins. There's a highly, highly toxic treatment that we know is toxic, and after all, the very first chemotherapeutic agents were made from mustard gas. Mustard gas was used as a military anti-personnel weapon to kill soldiers, and they'd inject the stuff directly into your veins. So there's a very highly toxic treatment that they hope will kill the cancer cells faster than it will kill the rest of the cells in your body. And sometimes it does. Most of the times it does not. And certainly over the long run, it's not very successful. So when the Gerson therapy, a detoxifying therapy, is used at the same time as chemotherapy, which is a highly toxic therapy, you're kind of operating at cross purposes. I would suggest that if you want to do one or the other, that you make a choice and place your bets on that one, and not do both at the same time. You're operating at cross purposes.
Okay. The reason why I ask is one of the critiques of the Gerson diet is that. It's not as well researched as it could be, that the practitioners of the Gerson diet haven't submitted enough evidence in a valid methodology to peer reviewed.
That's something that Dr. Gerson attempted repeatedly to submit his scientific papers to American medical journals. And they universally and uniformly rejected him. Not only that, but they won't even mention his name in the medical journals. Whereas so he took those same papers and he submitted them to European journals, and the European journals published them with great alacrity. So if you look at the actual literature. Dr. Gerson, and by the way, in the back of my biography, there is a bibliography of publications, and Gerson has 50 or 60 publications in the finest medical journals in the world, excepting only American medical journals. So he submitted lots and lots of evidence, and he submitted evidence to the National Cancer Institute, and he submitted evidence to the medical journals, and he repeatedly invited his colleagues to demonstrations of patients in New York City. The colleagues uniformly refused to attend.
Well, I think one of the issues is not that there were individuals.
And then they could say he never presented evidence, but it's because they were absolutely refused to look.
Okay, well, my understanding of the peer review process in medical journals is that you submit your research and a group of doctors comment on the validity of the research. They don't provide opinions as much as they offer criticism of the methodology of the study. And the articles that I was reading in, show prep talked about not taking into account the other cancer treatments that a patient was undergoing as part of why they considered the studies flawed.
Right, and so that is almost a hoot, because if the other cancer treatments were valid and if the other cancer treatments were helpful, people would not risk their lives and hopes on something that every medical person in the world is telling them is complete quackery. They just wouldn't do it if they were having success with the other cancer treatments. They only come to us after the other cancer treatments have failed and after they have been told, go home and die. They don't even come to us until that point.
So then to say,
oh, well, the reason that they recovered is because of the treatment that we gave them, not the treatment that you gave them, that's complete nonsense. The treatment that allopathic medicine gave them failed, and that's the only reason they come to us.
But that's one of the issues that the medical journals are looking at. The fact is that if you can't provide a control, it makes it hard to tell what exactly was creating that success, if there was success.
Well, you know, we've provided all kinds of evidence and all kind. They're not looking for evidence of success. They're looking for anything they can hang their hat on for failure. But if you look at our outcomes, if you look at liver cancer or pancreatic cancer or stage 4 melanoma, whether there's pretreatment or not, their results are zero. Or close enough to zero to not matter. Our results are 30% and 40%. So, you know, you can't say all of the people who, by the way, accidentally were cured by allopathic medicine also happened to go to Gerson therapy. You're once again stretching credibility.
So you feel that the medical community is suppressing your success. Why do you feel that?
Oh, absolutely. Why? Because cancer in the United States alone is a $350 billion a year business. Nobody wants to see that go away. Nobody wants to see the $1 million annual income of the chemotherapy oncologist go away. The pharmaceutical companies have a $3.5 trillion a year income to protect. Nobody wants to see that go away.
Well, if I may interject there, this kind of assumes that everyone works together, that they all go to a secret club at the end of the day and they all discuss, how can we make cancer stick around longer? How can we make this business more viable? But, I mean, you know, you take the independent researcher who's getting their funding from various sources, somebody out there is not going to have those same motivations. And if that's the case, what would their motivation be to keep this going?
Well, for one thing, there are precious few independent researchers, and there are precious few independent reviewers. The pharmaceutical companies have plastered all of them with money. They plaster the university. They fund the universities. They fund the university research departments. They fund the researchers. They have $3.5 trillion to play with. They can smear it around a lot. If you look at the medical journals, they have themselves complained that that the way that the pharmaceutical companies treat them is sort of like an advertising medium for their drugs. Negative research is suppressed. The researchers themselves and the reviewers are paid by the pharmaceutical companies. It's almost impossible to find a neutral reviewer. What would be the motivation? The motivation is, and you say that everybody gets together and discusses in some club. No, they don't. But the people who are in charge of the medical boards and the people who are in charge of the medical legislation are the ones who are paid off by the pharmaceutical companies to make laws and to make sure that the rules for publication and so forth are skewed towards the pharmaceutical companies. This has been done for about 100 years now.
Howard, we are out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm sorry about the technical difficulties. This is a very interesting topic, and I wish we would have had more time.
Yes, well, thank you for having me on.
No, absolutely. Have a good night.
Thank you very much, Howard.
Thank you very much.
All right.
And thanks to Nathan and Ryan also for keeping us up to date on interesting skeptical events around town, to Brownian for all his obsessive Google foo and for keeping me occupied, and my love and thanks to Sean and Ryan for almost keeping the show tech disaster free.
We almost made it today, but surprisingly in the end, Skype was more reliable than the telephone itself, which was strange. That's what we ended up relying on in the end. So Skype gremlins are okay. Those little leashes I put on them are working.
Chuck, can talk about Skype later. To everyone else playing a lot at home, See you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
We'll see you then.
Things sometimes fall out, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be discussing love and sex with Dr. Helen Fisher, biological anthropologist of Why We Love, the nature and chemistry of romantic love, and Why Him, Why Her. Find out about the biological roots of romantic love, the evolution of human emotions, and the real reason you keep falling for people that are awful for you. All on the next Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m., here on CJSR. You've also actually written a biography of your grandfather.
Dr. Max Gerson was called by Albert Schweitzer, Nobel laureate Albert Schweitzer, the most eminent medical genius ever. And yet in the 50 years after Gerson's death, as a matter of fact, this year marks the 50th year since his death, nobody else had documented his life. Nobody else had had written anything, any biography, any lengthy examination of his life in terms of not only how he discovered all of this, but it was a fascinating story anyway, because being a Jew in Nazi Germany, he had to flee. He kind of escaped by the skin of his teeth out of Germany, then out of Austria, hopscotched all over Europe, and finally came to the United States because that side of the Atlantic was becoming unsafe for Jews. And, of course, he had to extricate his family from these various different countries as well. So it's a fascinating story, and nobody...
Sorry to cut you off, Howard. We're getting a lot of interference with the phone line here. It's actually getting to the point of annoying squeaky clicking over here.
I'm sorry. Yes, I'm hearing it.
Oh, you hear it too, actually.
Okay. Would you mind if we just take a short break?
Not at all.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Well, we'll be right back with you there.
Do you want to call me back?
Actually, yes. We'll call you on your cell.
I will turn this line off.
Perfect. Thank you very much,
Howard.
Sorry
about that.